if it's not too late. Maybe we can save our souls.
Good interval, ladies and generals, and welcome to Spider on the Web number 79, the podcast that bravely marches
forward into the past.
That song, Nowhere, is the lead track of a very tasty CD called The Uncle Roy Show Volume 2 by Roy Schultz, backed by the Twang Thang, featuring his son Jonas Schultz on tenor, Dave Swanger on lead guitar, and Derek Lamar on bass. Uncle Roy sings and plays drums, harmonica, guitar, and mandolin, and you can hear more of him and his friends and order his CDs at www.theuncleroyshow.com, all one word. I love the words, if not us, who, if not now, when. The great blues man Watermelon Slim uses them in a song of his I played for you a few podcasts ago called The Bloody Burmese Blues. And my friend Stephen Gaskin rephrased them somewhat when he once said, "We are the people. We are this season's people. We are all the people there are this season. If we blow it, it's blown." We'll hear of Stephen again a bit later in this podcast. For now, I'd just like to say a slightly late happy 75th birthday to the man still living on the farm he founded in 1971 in Summertown, Tennessee. Anyway, as you can tell, Uncle Roy Schultz is an old-timer about my own age, and that's appropriate for this episode of Spider on the Web, which, as I said, will march boldly backwards. My theme this time is nostalgia, for no better reason than the fact that on the way out here to the shack I call my office, I noticed and picked up a magazine my friend Greg McKinnon once gifted me with, the Fall-Winter 1967 edition of Hi-Fi Buyer's Guide. The magazine has been extinct for so long I can find no reference to it anywhere on the internet, and its headline cover story is, "Why the Cassette Will Unseat the Stereo Disc." I must ask you to trust me when I say this was a provocative and controversial view when it was published. I was then a sophomore in college, passionately concerned about such things, and I loathed cassettes. Now, maybe this will convey how long ago the fall of 1967 was, if you weren't there. The magazine contains a review of a then-brand-new album called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, and an article by Thomas S. Knightel on the new music, which the magazine labels hippie grok. A specimen quote from Mr. Knightel's article, quote, "How to grok. While it's true that more than just a few members of the hip set dig the sounds while getting ready to take a trip, that is, a snort of LSD, the fantastic array of sounds assaulting them from their FM receivers and record players can often be sufficient to turn on many of them without any outside help," unquote. Reviewer Warren DeMott came rather closer to reality, saying of Sgt. Pepper, quote, "It's sagely psychedelic, and many a teeny bopper will proclaim it the greatest record ever made. Maybe it is. Calmer consideration will evaluate it as a major Beatles effort with a few good songs, some fuzzy thinking, some imaginative flights, pretentiousness, and an awesome aura of commerce," unquote. Right after Pepper, by the way, DeMott reviews an album of Beatles covers by an opera singer named Madame Kathy Berberian. Interestingly, she chose to title her album of Beatles covers Revolution, even though at that time in history, there was no Beatles song of that name. Anyway, that got me started thinking of the old days, so I dug out another album of that vintage. In fact, one reviewed in that very same issue with Sgt. Pepper. This one, however, I have the artist's permission to podcast from. It is Janis Ian's self-titled first album, long out of print and vinyl, but just reissued on CD last year. And here is a track from it that was also included in her career compilation CD, Best of Janis Ian, the Autobiography Collection, which was released at the same time as Janis's amazing 2009 autobiography, Society's Child. The song you're about to hear is the very first song she ever wrote at age 12, and it is called Hair of Spun Gold.
When I was just the age of five, my world had just come alive. Wondrous things to be seen and be done. All that I could think of was fun. With hair of spun gold, lips of ruby red, and eyes as deep as the deepest sea. And when I was just the age of 10, my life it did change again. I threw away all my childish toys and worked on getting noticed by the boys. And when I was just 13 years of age, going steady was all the rage. Mama picked me out the cutest little boy, my little leather jacketed toy. And tear of spun gold turned to black as night. Lips of ruby red would turn to pale pink. But now when I was 15 years of age, he had my hand in marriage. And when 15 years of age, in my arms I held my babe. And now I'm 21, you know I feel my life's over and done. And I'm looking down on my little child, wondering if she'll be so wild. She's got hair of spun gold, lips of ruby red, and eyes as deep as the deepest sea. And I'm looking down on my child, I swear she'll have the time. There'll be time to love, there'll be time to learn. For childish memories she won't yearn. Time to laugh, we'll find time to play. She won't have to throw her toys away. I swear to you, we'll wait for time to take its time.
12 years old, my God. Before I move on, look, Janice is a friend. The last short story I wrote was at her request for her anthology Stars, stories based on Janice Ian songs, co-edited with Mike Resnick, which I cannot recommend highly enough. I figure that entitles me to tease her just a bit, so let me show you how far she has come musically since Hair of Spun Gold, and play you one of her very latest tracks. This is a live recording from Ann Arbor, Michigan, last December 12th, and you may find this song hauntingly familiar. swelped me at that point. Janis and singer-songwriter Gretchen Peters, who had ably opened the show for her, closed it together by duetting on "I Swear to God, I Got You, Babe, and These Boots Are Made for Walking." Having established the nostalgia theme, I'm now going to read you a story of mine written so long ago that the only manuscript for it that survives is a carbon of one I typed on a Royal Manual typewriter, an extremely primitive word processor with no undo key or cut-and-paste features. The story first appeared in print some 31 years ago in 1979. I have not read it since then myself, and it will be interesting to see how it has aged compared to how I've aged. The Stephen Gaskin I quoted earlier has the briefest of appearances in this story, as I recall, by the way, though he is not named. Perhaps you'll recognize him as he passes. Oh, and one other historical note fans of my work may appreciate. The Scorpio Room, described in this story, actually existed once, for all too brief a moment of time. But it had no formal name at all, and so was generally known by the name of its proprietor, a folk singer named Mike Callahan. He had quite an influence on me, he did, and I hope he's out there alive somewhere in the world, but if he is, I don't know where. Without further ado, here is my novella, Satan's Children, copyright 1979 by Spider Robinson. A beginning is the end of something, always. Zachary Bishop saw the murder clearly, watched it happen, though he was not to realize it for over an hour. He might not have noticed it at all had it happened anywhere but at the Scorpio. The victim himself did not realize he had been murdered for nearly 10 minutes, and when he did, he made no outcry. It would have been pointless. There was no way to demonstrate that he was dead, let alone that he had been killed, nor anything whatever to be done about it. If the police had been informed, and somehow convinced of all the facts, they would have done their level best to forget them. The killer was perhaps as far from the compulsive confessor type as it is possible to be. Indeed, that was precisely his motive. It is difficult to imagine another crime at once so public and so clandestine. In any other club in the world, it would have been perfect. But since it happened at the Scorpio, it brought the world down like a house of cards. The Scorpio was one of those clubs that God sends every once in a long while to sustain the faithful. Benched from the folky circuit for reasons he refused to discuss, a musician named Ed Finnegan somehow convinced the owners of a Chinese restaurant near Dalhousie University to let him have their basement and an unreasonable sum of money. Finnegan used to claim that when he vacationed in Ireland, Blarney Stone tried to kiss him. He found that the basement comprised two large windowless rooms. The one just inside the front door he made into a rather conventional bar, save that it was not conventionally over-decorated. The second room, a much larger one which had once held the oil furnace, the building predated solar heat, he painted jet black and ceilinged with acoustic tile. He went then to the university and to other universities in Halifax, prowling halls and coffee houses, bars and dormitories, listening to every musician he heard. To a selected few, he introduced himself and explained that he was opening a club called Scorpio. It would include, he said, a large music room with a proper stage and spotlight. Within this music room, normal human speech would be forbidden to all save the performers. Anyone washing food or drink could raise their hand and, when the waitress responded, point to their order on the menu silk-screened into the tablecloth. The door to this room, Finnegan added, would be unlocked only between songs. The PA system was his own. 6 Shure mics with boom stands, 2 TAC mixers, a pair of 600-watt Toyota amps, 2 speaker columns, 4 wall speakers, and a dependable stage monitor. Wednesday and Thursday were open mic nights with a 30-minute per act limit, and all other nights were paying gigs. Finnegan apologized for the meagerness of the pay, little more than the traditional all-you-can-drink and hat privileges. The house piano, he added, was in tune. Within a month, the Scorpio was legend, and the Chinese restaurant upstairs had to close at sunset, for lack of parking. There have always been more good, serious musicians than there were places for them to play. Not a vein for the tapping, but an artery. Any serious musician will sell his or her soul for an intelligent, sensitive, listening audience. No other kind would put up Finnegan's House rules, and any other kind was ejected, at least as far as the bar, which featured a free jukebox, Irish coffee, and Lowenbrow draft. It was only because the house rules were so rigidly enforced that Zack happened to notice even that most inconspicuous of murders. It happened in the spring of his 24th year. He was about to do the last song in his mid-evening solo set. Jill sat at a stage side table nursing a plain orange juice and helping him with her wide brown eyes. The set had gone well so far, his guitar playing less sloppy than usual, his voice doing what he wanted it to, his audience responding well. But they were getting restive, time to bottle it up and bring Jill back on stage. While his subconscious searched its files for the right song, he kept the patter flowing. "No, really, it's true, Janties and Ladlemen of the Audio Radiance. I nearly had a contract with Chess Records once. A fellow named King come to see me from Chess, but I could see he just wanted old Zack Bishop for his pawn. He was a screaming queen, but he spent a whole night trying to rook me. And finally, I says, 'Come back when you can show me a check, mate.'" The crowd groaned dutifully, and Jill held her nose. Lifting her chin to do so exposed the delicate beauty of her throat, the soft grace of the place where it joined her shoulders, and his closing song was chosen. "No, but frivolously, folks," he said soberly. "It's nearly time to bring Jill on back up here and have her sing a few. But I've got one last spasm in me first. I guess you could say that this song was the proximate cause of Jill and me getting together in the first place. See, I met this lady, and all of a sudden it seemed like there was a whole lot of things we wanted to say to each other, and the only ones I could get out of my mouth had to do with, like, meaningful relationships and emotional commitments and how our personalities complemented each other and like that." He began to pick a simple C, E minor, A minor, G cycle in medium slow tempo, the ancient Gibson ringing richly, and Jill smiled. "But I knew that the main thing I wanted to say had nothing to do with that stuff. I knew I wasn't being totally honest, and so I had to write this song." And he sang.
My bedside, let there be sharing, uncounterfeitable sign of your caring. Take off the clothes of your body and mind. Bring me your nakedness, help me in mine. Help me believe that I'm worthy of trust. Bring me a love that includes honest lust. Warmth is for fire, fire is for burning. Love is for bringing an ending to yearning. For I love you in 100 ways. For this alone, but your loving is the sweetest loving I've ever known.
He was singing directly to Jill. He always sang this song directly to Jill, and although in any other bar or coffee house in the world an open fist fight would not have distracted his attention from her, his eye was caught now by a tall, massively bearded man in black leather who was insensitive enough to pick this moment to change seats. The man picked a stage-side table at which one other man was already seated, and in the split-second glance that Zack gave him, the bearded man met his eyes with a bold, almost challenging manner. Back to Jill.
Come to my bedside and let there be giving, licking and laughing and loving and living. Sing me a song that has never been sung. Dance at the end of my fingers and tongue. Take me inside you and bring up your knees. Wrap me so tight in your thighs and then squeeze. Or if you feel like it, you get on top. Love me however you please. Please don't stop. For I love
The obnoxious man was now trying to talk to the man he had joined, a rather elderly gentleman with shaggy white hair and ferocious mustaches. It was apparent that they were acquainted. Zack could see the old man try to shush his new table-mate, and he could see that the bearded man was unwilling to be shushed. Others in the audience were also having their attention distracted and resenting it. Mentally gritting his teeth, Zack forced his eyes away and threw himself into the bridge of the song.
I know just what you're thinking of. There's more to love than making love. There's much more to the flower than the blue. But every time we meet in bed, I find myself inside your head. Even as I'm entering your womb.
The shadow appeared as if by magic, and the shadow was large and wide and dark black, and he plainly had sand. None too gently, he kicked the bearded man's chair, and when the latter turned, held a finger to his lips. They glared at each other for a few seconds, and then the bearded man turned around again. He gave up trying to talk to the white-haired man, but Zack had the funny idea that his look of disappointment was counterfeit. He seemed, underneath it, to be somehow satisfied at being silenced. Taking the old man's left hand in his own, he produced a felt-tip pen and began writing on the other's palm. Quite angry now, Zack yanked his attention back to his song, wishing fiercely that he and Jill were alone.
So come to my bedside and let there be loving, twisting and moaning and thrusting and shoving. I will be gentle, you know that I can. For you I will be quite a singular man. Here's my identity, stamped on my genes. Take this my offering, know what it means. Let us become what we started to be on a long ago night when you first came with me. Oh lady, I love you in a hundred ways. Surely not for this long, but your loving is the sweetest loving I have ever known.
The applause was louder than usual. Sympathy for a delicate song shamefully treated. Zack smiled half ruefully at Jill, took a deep draught from the Löwenbräu on the empty chair beside him, and turned to deliver a stinging rebuke to the bearded man. But he was gone. Must have left the instant the song ended. Shadow was just closing the door behind him. The old man with the absurd mustaches sat alone, staring at the writing on his palm with a look of total puzzlement. Neither of them knew he was dead. The old man, too, rose and left the room as the applause trailed away. To hell with him, Zack decided. He put the beer down at his feet and waved Jill up onto the stage.
Thank you, folks, and now we'll bring Jill back on up here so she and I can do a medley of our hit.
The set went on. The reason so many musicians seem to go a little nutty when they achieve success, demanding absurd luxuries and royal treatment, is that prior to that time they have been customarily treated like pigs. In no other branch of the arts is the artist permitted so little dignity by his merchandisers and his audience, given so little respect or courtesy. Ed Finnegan was a musician himself, and he understood. He knew, for instance, that a soundproof dressing room is a pearl without price to a musician, so he figured out a cheap way to provide one. He simply erected a single soundproof wall, parallel to the music room's east wall and about 5 feet from it. The resulting corridor was wide enough to allow two men with guitars to pass each other safely, long enough to pace nervously, and silent enough to tune up or rehearse in. And it was peaceful enough to be an ideal place to linger after the last set, to recover from the enormous expenditure of energy, to enjoy the first tasted drink of the night, to hide from those dozens of eyes half seen through the spotlight glare, to take off the sweat-soaked image and lounge around in one's psychic underwear.
The north door led to the parking lot and was always locked to the outside. The south door opened onto stage right and had a large sign on its other side that said clearly, "If the performers wish to chat, sign autographs, accept drinks or tokes, or negotiate for your daughter's wedding gig, they will have left this door open and you won't be reading this. Please do not enter. Don't knock if you can help it. Respect us and we'll make better music. Thank you, Finnegan." It was Sanctuary. Zach customarily came off stage utterly exhausted, while Jill always finished a gig boiling over with nervous energy. Happily, this could be counterbalanced by their differing metabolic reactions to marijuana. It always gave Zach energy and mellowed Jill. The after-gig toke was becoming a ritual with them, one they looked forward to unconsciously. Tonight's toke was a little unusual. They were smoking a literal cigar of grass, GMI's latest marketing innovation, and assessing the validity of the product's advertising slogan, "It doesn't get you any higher, but it's more fun." Zach lay on his back on the rug, watching excess smoke drift lazily up from his mouth toward the high ceiling. An internal timer went off, and he exhaled, considered his head. "Let me see that pack," he said, rising up on one elbow. Jill, just finishing her own toke, nodded and passed over both cigar and pack. Zach turned the pack over, scanned it, and nodded. "Brilliant," he said. He was beginning to come out of his post-performance torpor. He toked and croaked, "Fucking brilliant," again. Jill managed to look a question while suppressing a cough. He exhaled. "Look," he said. "Guaranteed 100% pure marijuana. You see what that means?" "It means I'm not crazy. I really am stoned." No, this whole cigar business. You remember the weather we had last spring? Half the GMI dope fields got pasted with like 32 straight days of rain, which is terrific for growing rope and rotten for growing smoke. Stalks like bamboo, leaves like tiny and worth squat. Dope so piss poor you'd have to smoke a cigar full of it to get off. So what did they do?" He grinned wolfishly. "They made cigars. They bluffed it out, just made like they planned it and made cigars. They're pure grass, all right, but you'd have to be an idiot to smoke a whole cigar of good grass. And by Christ, I bet they pick up a big share of the market. These things are more fun." "What do you think that is?" Jill asked. "Why is it more fun? Is it just the exaggerated oral trip?" "Partly that," he admitted. "Oh, hell, back when I smoked tobacco, I knew that cigars were stronger, cooler, and tastier. I just couldn't afford them. But these aren't much more expensive than joints. Breaks down to about a dime a hit. Why, don't you like them?" She took another long toke, her expression going blank while she considered. Suddenly her eyes focused on him. "Does it turn you on to watch me smoke it?" she asked suddenly. He blushed to his hairline and stammered. "Honesty, remember? Like you said when you sang our song tonight. Trust me enough to be honest." "Well," he equivocated, "I hadn't thought about..." He trailed off, and they both said, "Bullshit," simultaneously, and broke up. "Yeah, it turns me on," he admitted. She regarded the cigar carefully, took a most sensuous toke. "Then I shall chain-smoke 'em all the way home," she said. "Here." She handed him the stogie, then began changing out of her stage clothes, making a small production out of it for him. 8 months we've been living together, Zach thought, and she hasn't lost that mischievous enthusiasm for making me horny. What a lady. He put the cigar in his teeth, waggled it, and rolled his eyes. "Why wait till we get home?" he leered. "I predict another Groucho Marx revival if those things catch on." Her bra landed on top of the blouse. "I like a gal with a strong will," he quoted, "or at least a weak won't." He rose and headed for her. She did not shrink away, but neither did she come alive in his arms. "Not here, Zach." "Why not? It was fun in that elevator, wasn't it?" "That was different. Someone could come in." "Come on, the place is closed. Finnegan and the Shadow are mopping up beer and counting the take. Nobody's gonna fuck a duck!" Startled, she pulled away and followed his gaze. A shining figure stood in the open doorway. She was by now wearing only ankle-length skirt and panties, and Zach had the skirt halfway down her hips, but she and he stood quite still, staring at the apparition. It was several moments after they began wishing for the power of motion that they recalled that they possessed it, moments more before they used it. "It was true," the old man said. He seemed to shine. He shimmered. He crackled with an energy only barely visible, only just intangible. His skin and clothes gave the impression of being on the verge of bursting spontaneously into flame.
He shone as the Christ must have shone, as the Buddha must have shone, and a Curlian photograph of him at that moment would have been a Nova blur. Zack had a sudden, inexplicable, and quite vivid recollection of the afternoon of his mother's funeral 5 years past. He remembered suddenly the way friends and relatives had regarded him as strangers, a little awed, as though he possessed some terrible new power. He remembered feeling at the time that they were correct, that by virtue of his grief and loss, he was somehow charged with a strange kind of energy. Intuitively, he had known that on that day of all days he could simply scream at the most determined and desperate mugger and frighten him away. On this day he could violate traffic laws with impunity. On this day he could stare down any man or woman alive. Coming in close personal contact with death had made him, for a time, a kind of temporary shaman. And the old man was quite dead, and knew it.
Your song, I mean. It was true. I was half afraid I'd find you two bickering, that all that affection was just a part of the act. Oh, thank God.
Zack had never seen anyone quite so utterly relieved. The old man was of medium height and appeared to be in robust health. Even his huge, ungainly mustaches could not completely hide the lines of over half a century of laughter and smiles. His complexion was ruddy, his features weather-beaten, and his eyes were infinitely kindly. His clothes were of a style which had not even been revived in years. Bell-bottom jeans, multicolored paisley shirt with purple predominating, a double strand of beads, and an Acadian scarf cap sloppily tied. He wore no jewelry other than the beads and no makeup. A kind of hippie Geppetto, Zack decided, so why am I paralyzed? Come in, Jill said, and Zack glanced sharply at her, then quickly back. The old man stepped into the room, leaving the door ajar. He stared from Zack to Jill and back again, from one pair of eyes to the other, and his own kindly eyes seemed to peel away onion layers of self until he gazed at their naked hearts. Zack suddenly wanted to cry, and that made him angry enough to throw off his trance. "It is the custom of the profession," he said coldly, "to knock and shout, 'Are you decent?' or 'Didn't you see the sign there on the door?" "Both of you are decent," the old man said positively. Then he seemed to snap out of a trance of his own. His eyes widened, and he saw Jill's half-nakedness for the first time. "Oh," he said explosively, and then his smile returned. "Now I'm supposed to apologize," he twinkled, "but it wouldn't be true. Oh, I'm sorry if I've upset you, but that's the last look I'll ever get. And you're lovely." He stared at Jill's bare breasts for a long moment, watched their nipples harden, and Zack marveled at his own inability to muster outrage. Jill just stood there. The old man pulled his eyes away. "Thank you both. Please sit down now. I have to say some preposterous things, and I haven't much time. Please hear me out before you ask questions, and please, please, believe me." Jill put on the new blouse and jeans, while Zack seated himself from long habit on the camel saddle edge of his guitar case. He was startled to discover the cigar still burning in his hand, stunned to see only a quarter inch of ash on the end. He started to offer it to the old man, changed his mind, started to offer it to Jill, changed his mind, dropped the thing on the carpet and stepped on it. "My name is Wesley George," the old man began. "Right," Zack said automatically. The old man sighed deeply. "I haven't much time," he repeated. "What the hell would Wesley George be doing in Halifax?" Zack started to say, but Jill cut him off sharply with, "He's Wesley George and he doesn't have much time," and before the intensity in her voice, he subsided. "Thank you," George said to Jill. "You perceive very well. I wonder how much you know already." "Almost nothing," Jill said flatly, "but I know what I know." He nodded. "Obviously you've both heard of me. Christ knows I'm notorious enough. But how much of it stuck? Given my name, how much do you know of me?" "You're the last great dope wizard," Zack said, "and you were one of the first. You used to work for one of the ethical, unquote, drug outfits, and you split. You synthesized DMT and didn't get credit for it. You developed Mellow Yellow. You made STP safe and dependable. You develop new psychedelics and sell them cheap, and sometimes you give them away, and some say you're stone nuts, and some say you're the holy goof himself. You followed in the footsteps of Osley Stanley, and you've never been successfully busted, and you're supposed to be richer than hell. A dealer friend of mine says you make molecules talk." "You helped buy the first federal decrim bill on grass," Jill said, "and blocked the cocaine bill, both from behind the scenes. You founded the Continent Movement and gave away 5 million TM pills in a single day in New York.
Some people say you don't exist, Zack added. As of now, they're right, George said. I've been murdered.
Jill gasped. Zack just stared.
In fact, you may have noticed it done, Wesley said to Zack. You remember Ziller, the bearded man who spoiled your last solo? Did you see him write this?
George held his left hand up, palm out. A black felt-tip pen had written a telephone number there, precisely along his lifeline.
Yeah, Zack agreed. So what? I dialed it a half hour ago. David Steinberg answered. He said that once he had a skull injury and the hospital was so cheap they put a paper plate in his head. He said the only side effect was that every sunny day he had to go on a picnic. I hung up the phone and I knew I was dead.
Dial a joke, Jill said wonderingly.
I don't get it, said Zack. I was supposed to meet Ziller here tonight, in the bar after your set. I couldn't understand why he came into the music room and tried to talk to me there. He knew better. He wanted to be shushed, so he'd have to write his urgent message on my hand. And the urgent message was literally a joke. So what he really wanted was to write on my hand with a felt-tip pen.
Jesus, Zack breathed, and Jill's face went featureless.
In the next 10 or 15 minutes, George said conversationally, I will have a fatal heart attack. It's an old CIA trick. A really first-rate autopsy might pick up some traces of a phosphoric acid ester, but I imagine Ziller and his people will be able to prevent that easily enough. They've got the building surrounded. I can't get as far as my car. You two are my last hope.
Zack's brain throbbed and his eyelids felt packed with sand. George's utter detachment was scary. It said that Wesley George was possessed by something that made his own death unimportant, and it might be catching. His words implied that it was, and that he proposed to infect Zack and Jill. Zack had seen North by Northwest and had no intention of letting other people's realities hang him out on Mount Rushmore if there were any even dishonorable way to dodge. But he could perceive pretty well himself, and he knew that whatever the old man had was a burden that would crush him even in death unless he could discharge it. Everything that was good in Zack yearned to answer the call in those kindly eyes, and the internal conflict, almost entirely subconscious, nearly tore him apart. There was an alternative. It would be easy to simply disbelieve the old man's every word. Was it plausible that this glowing, healthy man could spontaneously die, killed by a bad joke? Zack told himself that Hitler and Rasputin had used just such charisma to sell the most palpable idiocies, that this shining old man with the presence of a Buddha was only a compelling madman with paranoid delusions. Zack had never seen a picture of Wesley George. He remembered the fake Abby Hoffman who had snarled up the feds for so long. He pulled skepticism around himself like a scaly cloak, and he looked at those eyes again, and louder and more insistent even than Jill's voice had been, they said that the old man was Wesley George and that he didn't have much time. Zack swallowed something foul.
"Tell us," he said, and was proud that his voice came out firm.
"You understand that I may get you both dipped in soft shit, maybe killed?"
Zack and Jill said yes together and glanced at each other. This was a big step for both of them. There is all the difference in the world between agreeing to live together and agreeing to die together. Zack knew that whatever came afterward, they were married as of now, and he desperately wanted to think that through, but there was no time, no time. What's more important than death and marriage, he thought, and saw the same question on Jill's face, and then they turned back as one to Wesley George.
"Answer me a question first," the old man said.
Both nodded.
"Does the end justify the means?"
Zack thought hard and answered honestly. Much, he was sure, depended on this.
"I don't know," he said.
"Depends on the end," Jill said, "and the means."
George nodded, content. "People with a knee-jerk answer either way make me nervous," he said.
"All right, children, into your hands I place the fate of modern civilization. I bring you truth, and I think that the truth shall make you flee."
He glanced at his watch, displayed no visible reaction. But he took a pack of tobacco cigarettes from his shirt, lit one, and plainly gave his full attention to savoring the first toke.
Then he spoke, and for the first time Zack noticed that the old man's voice was a pipe organ with a double bass register, a great resonant baritone that Disraeli or Geronimo might have been proud to own. "I am a chemist. I have devoted my life to studying chemical aspects of consciousness and perception. My primary motivation has been the advancement of knowledge. My secondary motive has been to get people high. As many people, as many ways as possible. I think the biggest single problem in the world for almost the last 2 decades has been morale. Despairing people solve no problems. So I have pursued better living through chemistry, and I've made my share of mistakes. But in the main, I think the world has profited from my existence as much as I have from its. And now I find that I am become Prometheus, and that my friends want me dead just as badly as my enemies. I have synthesized truth. I have synthesized truth in my laboratory. I have distilled it into chemical substance. I have measured it in micrograms, prepared 12 vectors for its use. It's not that hard to make, and I believe that if its seeds are once sown on this planet, the changes it will make will be the biggest in human history. Everything in the world that is founded on lies may die." Zack groped for words, came up empty. He became aware that Jill's hand was clutching his tightly.
"What is truth?" asked jesting Pilot, and would not stay for answer. "Neither will I, I'm afraid. But I ought to at least clarify the question. I cannot claim to have objective truth. I have no assurance that there is such a thing. But I have subjective truth, and I know that exists. I knew a preacher once who got remarkable results by looking people square in the eye and simply saying, 'You do too know what I mean.'" A spasm crossed the old man's face, and his glowing aura flickered. Zack and Jill moved toward him as one, and he waved them away impatiently. "Even those of us who pay only lip service to the truth know what it is deep down in our hearts, and we all believe in it and know it when we see it. Even the best rationalization can fool only the surface mind that manufactures it. There is something beneath, call it the heart or the conscience, that knows better. It tenses up like a stiff neck muscle when you lie, in proportion to the size of the lie, and if it stiffens enough, it can kill you for revenge. Ask Richard Corey. Most people seem to me, in my cynical moments, to keep things stabilized at about the discomfort of a dislocated shoulder or a tooth about to abscess. They trade honesty off in small chunks for pleasure and wonder that their lives hold so little joy. Joy is incompatible with tensed shoulders and a stiff neck. You become uneasy with people in direct proportion to how many lies you have to keep track of in their presence. I have stumbled across a psychic muscle relaxant."
"Truth serum's been around a long time," Zack said.
"This is no more pentothal than acid is grass,"
George thundered, an Old Testament prophet enraged. He caught himself at once. In a single frantic instant, he seemed to extrude his anger, stare at it critically, tie it off, and amputate it in deliberate steps.
"Sorry, rushed. Look, pentothal will sometimes get you a truthful answer to a direct question. My drug imbues you with a strong desire to get straight with all the people you've been lying to, regardless of the consequences. Side effects include the usual accompaniments of confession, cathartic relief, euphoria to the point of exaltation, and a tendency to babble, and a new one, visual color effects extremely reminiscent of organic mescaline."
He winced again, clamped his jaw for a moment, then continued.
"That alone might have been enough to stand the world on its ear, but the gods are jollier than that. The stuff is water-soluble, damn near anything soluble, and skin-permeable, and as concentrated as hell. Worse than acid for dosage, and it can be taken into the body just about every way there is. For pentothal, you have to actually shoot up the subject, and you have to hit the vein. My stuff, Christ, you could let a drop of candle wax harden on your palm, put a pinpoint's worth on the wax, shake hands with a man, and dose him 6 or 7 hours' worth. You could put it on a spitball and shoot it through a straw. You could add it to nail polish or inject it into a toothpaste tube or roll it up in a joint or simply spray it from an atomizer. Put enough of it into a joint in a small room, and even the non-smokers will get off. The method Zillers used to assassinate me would work splendidly. There may be some kind of way to guard against it, some antidote or immunization, but I haven't found it yet. You see the implications, of course."
At some point during George's speech, Zack had reached the subconscious decision to believe him implicitly. With doubt had gone the last of his paralysis, and now his mind was racing faster than usual to catch up.
Give me a week and a barrel of hot coffee, and I think I could reason out most of the major implications. All I get now is that you can make people be truthful against their will. His expression was dark. Zack, I know this sounds like sophistry, but that's a matter of definition. Whoa! He held up his hands. I know, son, I know. The second commandment of Leary, thou shalt not alter thy brother's consciousness without his consent. So how about retroactive consent?
Say again.
The after effects. I've administered the drug to blind volunteers. They knew only that they were sampling a new psychedelic of unknown effect. In each case, I gave a preliminary attitude survey questionnaire with a few buried questions. In 14 cases, I satisfied myself that the subject would probably not have taken the drug if he or she had known about its effect. In about 3/4 of them, I damn well knew it. The effects were the same for all but one. All 14 of them experienced major life upheaval, usually irreversible and quite against their will, while under the effects of the drug. They all became violently angry at me after they came down. Then all 14 stormed off to try to put their lives back together. 13 of them were back within a week, asking me to lay another hit on them. Zack's eyes widened. Addictive on a single hit? Jesus. No, no, George said exasperatedly. It's not the drug that's addictive, damn it. It's the truth that's addictive. Every one of those people came back for, like, 3-4 hits, and then they stopped coming by. I checked up on the ones I was in a position to. They had just simply rearranged their lives on solid principles of truth and honesty and begun to live that way all the time. They didn't need the drug anymore. Every damn one of them thanked me. One of them fucked me, sweetly and lovingly, at my age. I was worried myself that the damned stuff might be addictive, so I had at least as many subjects who would probably have taken the drug knowingly, and all of them asked for more, and I told them no. Better than 3/4 of them have made similar life adjustments on their own without any further chemical aid. Zack, living in truth feels good, and it sticks in your memory. Like, it's a truism with acid heads that you can never truly remember what tripping feels like. You think you do, but every time you trip, it's like waking up all over again. You recognize the head coming on, and you dig that your memories of it were shadows. But this stuff you remember. You're left with a vivid set of memories of just exactly how good it felt to not have any psychic muscles bunched up for the first time since you were 2 years old. You remember joy, and you realize that you can recreate it just by not ever lying anymore. That's goddamn hard, so you look for any help you can get, and if you can't get any, you just take your best shot. Those people ended up happier, Zack. Zack, Jill, a long, long time ago, a doctor named Watt slapped me on the ass and forced me to live. It was very much against my will. I cried like hell, and family legend says I tried to bite him. Now my days are ended, and taking it all together, I'm very glad he went to the trouble. He has my retroactive consent. Wasn't his fault anyhow. My parents had already forced me to exist before I had a will for it to be against. And they have my retroactive consent. Many times in my life, good friends and even strangers have kicked my ass when it needed kicking. At least twice women have gently and compassionately kicked me out, all against my will, and they all have my retroactive consent. God bless 'em. Can it be immoral to dose folks if you get no complaints?
What about the 14th person? Jill asked.
George grimaced. Touché.
Beg pardon?
Nothing's perfect. The 14th man killed me.
Oh.
The temperature in the room was moderate, but George was drenched with sweat. His ruddy complexion was paling rapidly.
Look, you two make up your own minds. You can help them haul me out to the ambulance in a few minutes, and then walk away and forget you ever met me, if that's what you want. But I have to ask you, please, take over this karma for me. Someone has to, one way or the other. I seriously doubt that the drug will ever be found again.
Is there, like, a set of instructions for the stuff? Zack asked.
Involved, his head told him. Notes, molecules, diagrams. Somebody's getting in fucking involved.
Complete instructions for synthesis and about 10 liters of the goods in various forms. That's about enough to give everything on Earth with two legs a couple of hits apiece. I tell you, it's easy to make, and it's fucking hard to stumble across. If I die, it dies with me, maybe forever. Blind luck. I found it. Just blind.
Where?
Zack and Jill interrupted simultaneously. Wait a minute, you've got to understand. It's in a very public place. I thought that was a good idea at the time, but never mind. The point is, from the moment you pick up the stuff, you must be very, very careful. They don't have to physically touch you. Try not to let anyone come near you if you can help it, anyone at all. I'll know a Fed when I see one, Zack said grimly, north or south. No, not Feds, not any kind of Feds. Think that way and you're dead. It wasn't Feds that killed me.
Who then? Jill asked. In my line of work, I customarily do business with a loosely affiliated organization of non-syndicate drug dealers. It has no name. It is international in scope, and if it ever held a meeting, a substantial fraction of the world's wealth would sit in one room. I offered them this drug for distribution before I really understood what I had. Ziller is one of the principals in the group.
Jesus God, Zack breathed. Dealers had Wesley George snuffed? That's like the apostles offing Jesus.
One of them did, George pointed out sadly. Think it through, son. Dope dealers can't afford honesty.
But suppose the Feds did get hold of the stuff, Jill suggested.
Oh.
Or the syndicate, George agreed. Or their own customers, or what's the drug called, Jill asked.
Or the chemical name wouldn't mean a thing to some of the brightest chemists in the world, and I never planned to market it under that. Up until I knew what it was called, I called it the New Batch, and since then I've taken to calling it TWT. The whole truth.
Suddenly, urgency overtook him, and he was angry again. Listen, fuck this, he blazed. I mean, fuck all this garbage, okay? I haven't got time to waste on trivia. Will you do it is the important thing. Will you take on the karma I brought you? Will you turn truth loose on the world for me? Please, you...
He clutched at his right arm, screamed again in awful pain, and fell to the floor.
We promise, Jill was screaming, and Zack was thundering. Where, damn it? And Jill had George's head on her lap, and Zack had his hands, and they clutched like steel, and where, he shouted again, and George was bucking in agony, breathing in with great whooping gargles and breathing out with sprays of saliva, jaw muscles like bulging biceps on his face, and hitch, he managed through his teeth, and Zack tried hitchhike a locker at the hitching depot very fast, and then key in your pocket, and George borrowed energy from his death struggle to nod twice. Okay, Wesley, okay, all right, it's covered, man, and George relaxed all over at once and shat his pants.
They thought he was dead then, but the blue-gray eyelids rolled heavily up one last time, and he saw Jill's face over his, raining tears.
Nice tits, he said. Thanks, children. Thanks. Sorry.
And in the middle of the last word he did die, and his glowing aura died with him. The shadow was standing in the doorway, filling it full, breathing hard.
I heard the sound, man. Holy shit, man. What the fuck happened in here?
Zack's voice was perfect, his delivery impeccable, startled but not involved.
What can I tell you, Shadow? The old guy comes back to talk blues and like that and his pump quits. Call the croaker, will you? And pour me a triple.
Shit, the Shadow rumbled. Never dull night around this fucking joint. Hey, Finnegan! Finnegan, goddammit!
The big black bouncer left to find his boss. Zack found a numbered key in George's pants and turned to Jill. Their eyes met and locked.
Yes,
Jill said finally, and they both nodded. And then together they pried Zack's right hand from the clutching fingers of the dead dope wizard, and together they made him comfortable on the floor, and then they began packing up their instruments and gear. Intermission.
How does it feel when life doesn't seem real? And you're floating about on your own. Your life is uncertain, so you draw the curtain, pretending there's nobody home. But don't theorize, look in your eyes. They can't tell lies, though you disguise what you see. The mirror is free. We once had a savior, but by our behavior, the one that was worth it is gone. Songbirds are talking, and the runners are walking. A prodigal son is coming home. Don't theorize, look in his eyes. They won't tell lies, but if he defies what you see, he'll give you the key. So built a computer and we programmed ourselves not to see the truth and the lying, the dead and the dying, a silent majority. But don't theorize, look in their eyes, are they telling lies? The ones that they learn on TV. What a way to be free. Be yourself. Be yourself. Free yourself. Free yourself. See yourself. See yourself. And you can free yourself. Be yourself. Be yourself. Be yourself.
At this point, I find myself on the horns of a dilemma, as opposed to a dilemma of the horn, like being out of Viagra. Our allotted hour is already long gone, and to my own surprise, I'm well less than two-thirds of the way through Satan's Children. We're out of time. I'm out of steam and time, and I have a novel cooling on the forge as we speak that I must get back to soon if I want to keep the mortgage paid. So I'm going to have to extend this intermission for a couple of weeks and finish reading the novella in my next installment. That will be less than a half hour of reading, but the next podcast was meant to be an old music one anyway, so what the hell? Before I go, I want to publicly thank the immortal Harlan Ellison for helping my darling Jeannie cope with the expenses of her battle with cancer by auctioning off dinner with Harlan and Susan a while ago as part of the Dream for Jeannie auctions that Jan Schroeder is still running on eBay. See earlier podcasts or my website homepage for details. And I'd like now to pass on Harlan's warming blog report of how it all went, which you can find at harlanellison.com. Harlan titled it, Praising Tom Campbell. Loath as I am to post here, and as you know, I seldom post anywhere else in this terra incognita of bites, when it's the sort of personal day-to-day that heat rashes Facebook and the rest, on occasion, a remarkable thing comes to pass, and like you, I am compelled to draw some small notice to it. Short background. Some months ago last year, one of the two regular Jans who enrich us with their presences here posted a Gardy Lou that the writer Spider Robinson's most excellent co-writer and wife, Jeannie, was in dire medical straits. A Katrina-style sandbagging operation amidst Spider and Jeannie's friends surged forth sight to sight on the internet in an attempt to raise that gargantuan amount needed for surgery et al., and the true and faithful responded staunchly. Jeannie is today medically far better than she was at the outset. I would say more specifically, but in truth, I know not much more than that. I'm sure one of our Jans or someone closer to Spider will enhance the foregoing. For our part, Susan and I entered the list of auction items with a guarantee to the highest bidder of dinner for two with that cute little Ellison couple. The winner, if I can be allowed the cognomen, was a gentleman from Washington State named Tom Campbell. He paid a potload. We were supposed to have done that thing back last August-December, but health at both ends put the kibosh on that. But night before last, Thursday, 18 February 2010, Tom flew down. I put together an all-star cast of Algonquin Roundtable conversational stars. I do not feel comfortable listing all 12. And we had a banquet at Mogo's Mongolian Barbecue, one of my favorite joints, for more than 30 years. Now here's the jaw-dropping part. This lovely man, Tom Campbell, who had laid out of pocket a lot of money to sit and watch me shovel groceries down my neck, outflanked me, outplayed me, outsmarted me, way outclassed me, and well before I was screaming at Lisa, our waitress, to break up the checks into Dutch treat sections, this Campbell guy had prepaid damn near when we all walked into the restaurant 5 hours earlier and wouldn't let anyone, particularly me, pay a cent. I swear, I felt like Campbell's bitch. In this life, we seldom meet the kind of diamond-pure menches our moms and dads wanted us to grow up to be. Tom Campbell is class. I had to impart this. I have no idea if he'll ever see it, but it had to be logged in somewhere, if not here, then possibly carved into the northern massif of the Rock of Eternity. a good weekend to all of you, and very awestruck hugs and such to Mr. Tom Campbell. Your pal, Harlan. Bless your heart and tripes, Harlan, and all of Susan's internal organs as well. The latest news on Jeannie has been encouraging. Her blood platelet levels have come back up enough to allow her to resume oral chemo, which will hopefully knock back the biliary cancer cells a few steps. For now, she is reasonably well and strong and happy, doing a lot of meditation and delighting every day in the healing bath of our baby granddaughter's gaze, the best medicine we've found yet. Here to take us out is an old friend and shipmate who just won another of Jan Schroeder's Dream for Jeannie eBay auctions and scored the complete 12-volume set of Theodore Sturgeon's short work I've plugged for the past two podcasts for, I don't have her authorization to name the amount, so let's just say an astonishing sum. Gail has a superb studio version of this song on her CD Common Good, but this is a live version from the disc Live at Jessel's. Both CDs can be sampled and purchased at GailMead.com. Go on, Gail. Tell them all the secret of life.
The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time . Any fool can do it . There ain't nothing to it. Cause nobody knows how we got to the top of the hill . Since we're on our way down, we might as well enjoy the ride. The secret of love is opening up your heart. It's okay to feel afraid, but don't let that stand in your way. 'Cause anyone knows that love is the only road. Since we're only here for a while, we might as well show some style. Give us a smile, isn't it a lovely ride? Sliding down, try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. Now the thing about time is that time isn't really real. It's just your point of view. How does it feel for you? Einstein said we could never understand it all. Planets spinning through space, that smile upon your face. Welcome to the human race. Some kind of lovely ride. I'll be sliding down, try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. Isn't it a lovely ride? See me sliding down, try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Thank you for coming by, brothers and sisters, and especially for continuing to buy my novels, story collections, audiobooks, and CD. I hope I've been able to help you in enjoying the passage of time. Come back in a couple of weeks, and I'll finish Satan's Children for you and play you some amazing music in Spider on the Web number 80.